Delia Creaming Her Legs, a story by Robert McCain. Winter, 1988, Part 1. Max Fishman, in his nightshirt, stood amid the wreckage of his store. Little cubes of plate glass gleamed at his slippered feet, and a cold draft, menacing in its presence indoors, ruffled the black cushions, now devoid of their gold bands, and set the crepe bell hanging in the half-light, swaying festively. Old-fashioned, wearing a nightshirt, as old-fashioned in its way as leaving in the windows overnight those gold rings, the watches with their jeweled movements, the Seth Thomas travel clocks in their leather wallets, the cameras in the toasters and the electric mixers, instead of going to the bother of bringing everything in. "Oi," he said. He was old and fat, and this tonight would make him no younger and no skinnier. He had heard what he had heard. Overhead, a dark shape flitted by. Was that a bat? "And where, I ask," he added, "is the damn cat, just when you need him?" Max Fishman's cat, Mr. J.P. Morgan, was in Ganago nearly as famous as his master, at least in the size department. Max, when he stepped up on Dr. Weisenfeld's scales, weighed in at 300 pounds or so, a figure Max was not unproud of. J.P. Morgan, who prowled the windows of Fishman's jewelry and small appliances, brushing his lush caramel fur against those chrome toasters, and raising his topaz eyes over the crystal punch bowls to fix unsuspecting window shoppers in his burning gaze, weighed, when he settled on one of Max's bathroom scales to lick his paws, 42 pounds or so himself, a figure his master also took some pride in. The phone began to jingle. Max shuffled over, lifted it, and interrupted his wife in mid-squeal. "It's all right, Delia. It's all right, sweetie." "How could it be all right? You shouldn't be down there alone, Max." "Sweetie, it's all right." Feeling cool fur against his bare shin, Max withdrew his previous complaint. Mr. Morgan drove them off. "You want to call the police and toss down my pants? I'm up. I might as well stay up. Out the hole in my window, I can sell donuts." "Max, don't be a fool. They might come back." "Delia, my heart," he explained to the woman who, so many decades ago, cost him the love of his Brooklyn family. "Thieves rarely provide encores, no matter how swell their aim with the old brick is. Now, my pants, sweetie, please." When he switched on the fluorescent lights, he saw the blood, smears on the jagged triangular shards, still standing in the window frame, gouts on the shelves. The thief had worked fast, knowledgeably, if not sure-fingeredly, snatching the single reflex cameras, scooping up the rings and watches, bypassing the brooches, lunging for the gold chains. Perhaps not a finger? A forearm vein? An artery? It didn't matter. Captain McKenzie of the Ganago PD was not about to set loose the bloodhounds. That carpenter, whose name he could never remember, he needed to call him, and then Kaplan's Glassworks. Sunday was Christmas. This was Wednesday, actually Thursday. All his clocks cheerfully chimed 3 a.m., the start of the biggest weekend of the year. How long would it take to fix his store? What would it cost? Ah, who knew? He found, just inside the stairwell door, in a lovingly arranged pile, his wide drawers and even wider trousers, his white shirt and fuchsia bow tie, his support stockings and shoes, and, lying pressed and folded on top, a clean handkerchief. Bless women, Max thought, exhausting his nose into the handkerchief. He used the bathroom, made sure everything that way was in order, and then fetched a broom and dustpan. He was a tidy man, which was to a shopkeeper's credit. But he had no excuse. Break-ins in a poor town, a town on the skids after its steelworks had closed, were common. Who was he so special to think he should be spared? Somebody wormed their way down a ventilation shaft of the T&V supermarket and left sooty fingerprints all over the hams. Somebody swiped the day's meager gleanings from the wooden till Nelson's son still used in Gleason's English shoes. The row bars were shot up so regularly who could count. Frankly, he had no excuse in the first place to persist in this foolish notion to keep a store open, at his age, in such a town. When the phone rang again, he leaned his broom against a time-worn Santa cutout. Delia, please, my love, go back to sleep. With you down there with a big hole in your window, I'm calling Saul. He saw the gathering creases beside the mouth, the accordion folds multiplying on his wife's cheeks, the shrunken breasts, the spotted hands, as he saw the shambling 80-year-old walrus he had become. Fate will blow you down, as it must. He knew that, but he worried about his wife, her erratic heartbeat, her balance on the stairs. He worried especially about the years-long depression that had, like a shroud, lowered over her. But when Max Fishman looked at his wife, he still saw, as well, the small, exquisite Italian girl with darting eyes, the mischievous grin, and the big, simple, silly laugh. They had laughed in bed. Was there any God in any heaven who had not envied them to laugh in bed so long ago? Darling, please, he reasoned with her, don't disturb the children. They have busy, important lives. What is the name of that man I can never remember, the carpenter one? He put a nail right through the cupboard, Max. Anyone can make a mistake, sweetie. It was a long nail. But until someone erects the board over my window, I report I am going nowhere soon. William Gallagher. Thank you, sweetie. I will tell him to bring shorter nails this time. Now go back to bed. Don't disturb the children. Why don't you call Peach?
Ilya, Max, a man who seldom grumbled. Let me assure you, the last person on the face of the earth I'm going to call is Peach Litchfield. Go to bed, sweetie. It's because I'm a shitska, isn't it? The calculus of marriage. He knew what she meant, and knew it had nothing to do with ethnic slurs. It's wrong to go on punishing yourself. It was the will of God. It wasn't God, Max. It was politicians. About this he knew enough not to argue. He chose the easier point to contest. My love, by now you are more Jewish than I am. Go to bed. Why aren't the police there? What's keeping them, Max?
I don't know, pet. Perhaps they're busy stopping crime.
Well, if this is all a better job they can do at it, they ought to be ashamed of themselves. Shouldn't we all, Max thought.
Scrupulous to keep grime off his clothes, he maneuvered a smelly barrel in from the alley and delicately deposited within the long scimitars of shattered glass. In the quiet evening, the sound of breaking glass was jarring. He searched for a brick or stone, decided the thief, and it was a single individual, that he knew, had thoughtfully taken it with him. But Max Fishman, too, was a thoughtful man. Before finishing, he saved aside a particularly bloody specimen of glass. The police would want a list of stolen goods. Settling in at his bench, J.P. Morgan curled beside him in a caramel ball under the glow of the gooseneck lamp. Max began his list. It was, in fact, the officer's second question. The first was, did your alarm sound? We got no record of it at the station. Two young men, one black, one white. They looked tired. Their shirts were soiled, and the instruments of modern crime prevention, dangling from their belts, clanked. The equipment seemed to handicap them, make them ungainly, as if they might at any moment topple over or be captured by a huge magnet. The lights of their cruiser sent into the store fleeting blue orbs skittering across the merchandise. Max understood that his size bothered people, especially figures of authority. Not only did he block their view of the horizon, he usually blocked their view of the sun as well. An uncomfortable question, but he had anticipated it. Parts I can't get anymore for the alarm. I guess it's too old.
Your alarm is broke?
The white policeman said. How long has it been broke?
I don't know. A while.
At least you know it was taken, the black policeman asked.
I do.
Max's heart sometimes would send a wave of pain through his chest. He patted his shirt, swallowed, handed over his list. Retail, $4,400.
You had that much hanging out in the street and no alarm?
The white policeman clutched his belt with both hands, as if to brace himself.
Are you some sort of numbskull or what?
His partner scowled at him.
Sorry, he apologized.
But surely you understand you can't do that. How to tell people, how to describe it to them. The joy of seeing a shop window at night, snow falling perhaps, a display ablaze with color and light, watches and rings and bracelets, brass clocks beneath crystal domes, these beautiful objects of civilization. Things revered since human beings have become aware of tool and adornment. These were gold bands one morning you slid across two knuckles, and a lifetime later buried on that same hand. Lockets your wife and aunt and sisters slipped around their necks and warmed with their flesh. Had it come to this, that he had to empty his displays every night, so they resembled nothing so much as the dingy windows of a thrift shop, three old shoes on a shelf? Had it?
It had.
Max humbly accepted his scolding. It won't happen again, he promised the tired constables with dirty shirts.
Got any idea who'd done it? You didn't see them, of course.
A question he hadn't expected. Actually, he knew who had perpetrated the crime, knew the villain and the villain's squealing water pump. He had heard what he had heard. A binding spindle, he supposed. Cars didn't really interest him. For the third child, the one who didn't live long enough to find a wife and raise a family, who perished so far from home, Max said a silent prayer, then gazed over at Mr. Morgan, who was burying his whiskered cheek against the rim of the lampshade. "Oi," he said, "beats me." Part 2. By the time that he and Velia, wed by a justice of the peace in New Jersey, came to Ganago in the waning days of the Depression, Plan 13 on 8th Hill had long been in decline. The Hotel Himmelsblock maintained a scandalous infamy, and just down the street from Max and Vilya's light housekeeping rooms, the tiny toy shop with the big name that Max loved, Dufresne's miniature train and toy repertorium, still smelled of machine oil and balsa wood and airplane dope. But White Ganago, having decided that Plan 13 would be where the blacks moving up from the south to labor in the mill would live, poured from 8th Hill. Droves. Seldom these days did Max have occasion to come up here. It was dangerous on the hill, and a white man, a fat old jeweler, would be an easy mark. But a brick sailing through your window? What choice does that leave you? He had closed his store at 6 and called up Devilia to tell her he was going out without telling her where. He shook his head at the repugnant rectangle of blonde wood that William Gallagher had nailed over his window as securely as if the man were hammering down for eternity the lid of a coffin, and shrugged on his overcoat. He could find but one glove. Cruising Booker Street in his 16-year-old Buick, not, he noted, with its rusted fenders entirely out of place on Plant 13, Max took in the abandoned storefronts and gray-dusted windows, and the buildings gone even further into decay, many of them burned-out carcasses. The closure of the steelworks 5 years ago had, to be sure, clobbered all of Ganego. One more casualty in an inexorable hollowing out of America's industrial heartland. But Plan 13, it had sunk utterly. Turning off Booker, he pulled to the curb before a building that had once housed Ganego's only socialist trade journal. In the upper windows, lights glowed. He discovered the outside door stupidly unlocked, and taking it slowly so as not to get his heart going, picked his way up the stairwell. He had been here before. He recalled the smell of gas from poorly ventilated heaters. Somewhere a baby burbled, and a weatherman advised people to take caution on slippery walks. Max paused before a door from which the aroma of cooking onions seeped. His stomach growled longingly. When no one responded to his polite knock, he knocked more sternly. That also going unheeded, he bellowed, "Sarah Jane, open the door." The door parted 2 inches against its chain. "What do you want, Max?" Even the slender slice of face brought back the whole face, the lovely, yellow-skinned girl his stockroom assistant and general handyman brought into the store one night after closing and proudly introduced Max to. They spent hours helping the girl in her agonies decide which of the modest rings Peach Litchfield could afford and that she would agree to wear on her finger, a speck of a diamond. "Sarah Jane, you know why I'm here, so let's stop with the foolishness already. You don't want me to hand this over to the police." She brought him into the steamy kitchen. A baby in a high chair played with his green vegetables on the tray. A young girl was absorbed in a nature show on the television. A boy, in age somewhere between girl and baby, was navigating his fleet of metal trucks through the table legs. Sarah Jane was no longer the bashful, overwhelmed girl who had broken down into tears over a tiny diamond. Her face had hardened. "Time will blow you down." Her eyes met his. "He's a good man, Max. He doesn't drink. He doesn't carry on." "I know that. He was never late. Not a day. I don't think he was even ever sick." Max had been fortunate in life. Not everybody is. The world had chosen to reward his cleverness and industry. When he and Velia took the plunge and leased a mouse-ridden storefront on Roosevelt Avenue, he bravely hung out his sign, and the world showed up. More of a fix-it man, he repaired watches and clocks and bracelets, but anything, really, tube radios, wind-up toys, pots and pans, umbrellas. The single back room served as their sitting room, kitchen, bedroom. They had babies and diapers and lamb stews that stank up the shop, and still the world came. He was hot under the overcoat tonight. He felt sweat on his body, a sensation he disliked. For the boy who didn't live long enough to change an infant's diaper, he said silent Kaddish and agreed with the wife of Peach Litchfield. "I had to let him go. It had nothing to do with his work habit. I never had anything but good words for Peach." "This town is dying, Sarah Jane. My business is dying." She turned back to the stove, unmoved. "How is Velia?" "The holidays," Max said. "It's always worse around the holidays. The holidays bring it all back." "If he's not here, Sarah Jane, then where is he? This isn't a trivial matter." She turned off the flame under the skillet, in the bedroom. Peach sat on the bed, leaning against the headboard. He was watching a television on the dresser. Men in uniforms and helmets skated across the white rink, colliding with each other. It was warm in here, too. One sleeve of Peach's shirt was rolled up, the right one. The other dangled to the wrist, unbuttoned. Through the flannel, a bulge showed. So, it had been a forearm, Max thought. He could have bled to death. What do you want, Max?
Just what belongs to me.
I got no idea what you're talking about. I heard about your window. Sorry about that. Peach Litchfield was a small man, the skin of his face drawn against his cheekbones, his arms sinewy, hands prominent with veins. He had been an industrious worker, Max's left-handed handyman. His wife was correct about that. He had also been a talented pitcher, showing up for work sometimes still in his uniforms. He played semi-professional ball, sent postcards from Rochester, Tulsa, Kansas City. He was almost good enough to make a life of it. When Peach consented to look at him, Max said, "Maybe somebody else has a car with a defective water pump. That could be. But I don't think anyone else has your blood. It's not each other we should be fighting, Peach. All I want is what belongs to me. Search the house. I don't got anything of yours." His shoes pinched, his body stank, and he was famished. But he was a tidy man, a scrupulous man. Max knew the ground he stood on. "All right, Peach, let's leave it at this. Everything on my bench by 10 tomorrow, or else I go to the police. And if you're fool enough to have fenced it already, I want $2,200.
That with your markup?
More than 20 years he had trusted this man. "I heard what I heard, Peach." He noticed, as he came through the kitchen, that the onions were happily sautéing once again. Veolia no longer cooked, a small tragedy lodged in the grater. Sarah Jane, back resolutely to him, spoke. "What do you want, Max? What's he supposed to do?"
"I want my merchandise. Tomorrow. By 10.
Her shoulder sagged. "He'll be there. How much is your window going to be?" Max recollected, out of nowhere, the little girl's name, Bonnie. She had 3 pigtails. With the carpenter and the glazier, 400, maybe a bit less. Turning suddenly, Sarah Jane strode up to him, and fumbling with a potholder, slid her ring off her finger. She held it out. "Here, for your window." Max involuntarily took a step back. "He can't find work, Max. There's no work in this town." Frustrated, furious, Sarah Jane flung the potholder aside and thrust the diamond ring at him. "Take it. Take it. I don't want it." Not knowing what to do, embarrassed, vexed with these people, feeling old and useless, Max accepted the small ring in his big hand and buried his hand in his overcoat pocket. Part 3. Past glories. The store bedecked with the Goyim's fairy tale holiday, elves and flying reindeer, and the fragrance of balsam from a tree sold personally by the good father Upsatnik. Customers, boxes in arms, standing patiently, or not so patiently, in long lines. 3 children running critical missions from stockroom to showroom. 2, even 1 year, 3 sales associates, plus his assistant ferrying unwieldy bundles out to double-parked cars. And him, fat and rosy in a jolly Santa cap, covering an even-then bald pate, sapphire on his pinky that would bring a glow to a sultan's cheeks. And the storekeeper's wife, dazzling, pendant earrings and pearl necklaces and woven gold bracelets, her dresses like living creatures stirring at her knees, her slender ankles in stiletto heels that rasped across the tile floor. All this the brooding proprietor remembers as he sits in his quiet store this damp morning, the 23rd of December, all those years gone by. He had no bones to pick with anybody's deity. Broad-minded he was, ecumenical he was. He liked Christmas. He even liked Bing Crosby. Traffic was desultory. He sold some kitchenware, a very nice water pitcher, an electric razor, a Schaefer fountain pen. He'd had the dream again last night. In this variant, he had come racing out of his parents' Brooklyn tenement, carrying his youngest, whom the dream had returned to a child. The boy was feverish, sick. Frantic, Max raced down one street, then another. But the streets had changed. He became confused. And then at some point, his heart pounding in pain, he lost the child. The boy vanished from his arms. At 10:15, a worried Sarah Jane called. "Is he there, Max? Did he come?" "It's a tomb." In his suit pocket rested a little lump in a white envelope. The stone needed to be removed from its dwarf setting and put into play. Inexpensive diamonds might be the only thing he could sell today. Maybe the police will liven things up. He got a call early and left. He'll be there, Max, I promise. Rain began falling. Very cold, a degree or so from sleet. And Max recalled what the weatherman had cautioned last night. At 11, Maddie, his last remaining sales associate, stomped in. Her trench coat sodden, she popped her umbrella out the door to fling off the water. Max called Peach's number and received no answer. Deciding against for the moment of removing Sarah Jane's diamond from its setting, he ran the ring through a cycle in the ultrasonic, then buffed the stone and returned the ring to his pocket. Saul, his oldest, the cigar-smoking attorney who had turned 50 this year, promised to bring the family later, and Benjamin, the ophthalmologist, promised the same. Even if Max no longer needed extra help, even if he didn't sell as much as a Presto burger, the family would be together again under one roof as another winter solstice passed. Not a whole family, no, never that again. But the store would ring with voices. Bing Crosby would croon, and J.P. Morgan would scrabble up to a tall perch and gaze down at the babbling crowds in leonine indifference. Max looked up at his old tin ceiling, looked, as it were, through his ceiling to the apartment above. Would Velia come down? Would she join them? "Maddie?" Max slipped to her holiday bonus. Newly engaged, the girl tucked the cash into her bra. "I think it'll pick up, Max." And indeed, toward mid-afternoon, with sleet pattering the intact window and smearing the colored bulbs, yawning in low strings over Roosevelt Avenue, Max, the blood in his veins of half a millennium of shopkeepers, felt the store's pulse quickening. The bell jangled merrily. The floor mats became sopping, and the focus shifted to more serious gifts, serious jewelry for fiancés and wives, serious cameras and electronics for the men, serious appliances for the house. Saul and family came spilling in, then Ben and his, all exclaiming over the horrendous parkway traffic, the worst they'd ever seen, and one of the grandchildren sold, on her own, a $7,000 pair ruby pendant necklace. A figure that made the girl, after the gentleman buyer had slipped into the night with his single tiny package, press both her palms to her ears and gasp. But no Velia, no Peach Litchfield. It was when Max was waiting on William Gallagher, come to inspect his handiwork, and tempted into considering the purchase of a pair of brass candelabras that had stood on the counter a dozen years unsold, that Maddie whispered, "Max," in the back. I told him he could just leave it. but he wants to talk to you." Peach was standing beside what had once been his own desk. On the blotter sat a rain-splattered cardboard box. "It's everything," he said. "Sorry I couldn't come sooner. I was offered work, so I had to take it." He was wearing a gray sweatshirt, dirty and wet. No hat, no coat. The dark planes of his face glistened like the brown-black handles of the burins on Max's bench. "That's good," Max said sincerely. "I'm happy to hear you got work, Peach." He shook off Max's enthusiasm. "Day work, loading crates, $20. I'll buy the kids a pizza." He had just retailed a necklace for $7,000, a necklace that had cost him half that. But he'd had to take the risk of investing in the piece in the first place, of sinking that money in up front. He had had to erect a store and a reputation around the necklace, worthy of its value, to justify the tag dangling from it. He paid taxes and workers' compensation. The world does not deal fairly with people. Fairness, even merit, has little to do with it. His son had been torn in three by bullets. It wasn't merit that got Zeke born in 1947 and Peach Litchfield in 1950. And it wasn't fairness that placed both of them at the mercy of the draft board in 1969. There was, that year, a lottery. Peach won, Zeke lost. But still, the man had not dumped the box and slunk off into the night. Max recalled Peach home forever from his baseball wanderings, trying to explain how big the men in professional sports were, how fast the pitchers threw. He recalled seeing the loss of a boy's dreams registering in a man's face. But even so, could you ever trust someone who had stolen from you? "I have a proposition," Max said. "We're doing better than I thought we would. I could use some help tomorrow, and I'm going to need to put some money into this building this winter." Peach would not meet his eyes. "Look, I'm sorry about your window, Max. It was a jackass thing to do, but I brung it all back, all your stuff. We don't need your charity." Max removed the envelope from his inside pocket. "Sarah Jane asked me to clean this for her. She really should have it done more often. It's a very pretty stone." "Not charity, Peach. The roof leaks. The rooms need a coat of paint to freshen them. And I need a new alarm." Part 4. From the vantage point of his height, Max could see everything in his store, his merchandise, his customers, especially the shifty ones, his children, and now their children. But where his eyes had always returned to had been his wife. Velia's withdrawal from the life of the store had been his second greatest sorrow. Lingering in the stockroom after Peach had left, Max found his old Santa cap. He straightened his Christmas bow tie. Mr. Morgan, annoyed with human beings, lay asleep under the desk lamp. On his holidays, J.P. got Sicilian sardines straight out of the tin. Max caressed the animal's silky ear, rubbed his finger along his whiskered cheek. Why do cats like that so much? When you live a lifetime with someone, you accumulate so many memories, it becomes an accounting task to keep them organized. But among the thousands of memories Max had of his wife, there were those he particularly treasured. The one he was thinking of now took place in this room 40 years ago. Coming in from the shop, he surprised Velia, fresh from their tiny corner tub in the back bathroom. She lay in bed naked, applying lotion to her legs. In his memory's ledger books, Max labeled the scene Velia creaming her legs. First one leg lifted languidly into the air, creamed until it shone. Then the other lifted and creamed, while the dark bush at the base of the woman's belly glistened with drops of bath water. He found her in the darkened living room before the television. His heart sent him some small, sharp pains, which he disguised. "Will you come down?" he asked, softly, gently. "The boys are here." She ignored his question. "How is trade, Max?" "Marcia sold a very expensive piece." "I'm happy for you." "Everybody's asking about you." "Max, I'm not dressed." "After we close, we can all sit in the back. I'll order pizza for everyone." "Why, Max? Why?" Her face was bathed in the lurid colors from the television. He worried when Velia went out, worried when she didn't. He thought the violence of the boy's death would tear them apart, rend their marriage, as the bullets had rent his son's body, and it almost had. Before the draft, Velia had pleaded with Zeke to flee to Canada. Max had disapproved. It was, ever since, an argument he had rued and rued and rued, winning. Zeke was more at home in the shop than the other boys. He might have joined his father some day. Max crossed the room and kissed the top of his wife's head. "I don't know why, Velia. All those lives, Max, stopped for no reason, just stopped." For this woman, he had sold his soul. If it had 100 lives and 100 souls, he would have, for her, sold every last one. "I know, Pat." She leaned her head against his leg. "Do you want me to come down, Max?" "I miss you, my love," he said. This story appeared in a journal called The MacGuffin, the spring-summer issue, 2013, volume 29, number 3. The story is copyright 2015, Robert McCain.